Hello, I'm Rachel Marshall, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit, and welcome to the May 2011 roundup from the Cochrane Library. In this month's roundup, we'll hear from authors of Cochrane Reviews on consumer-oriented interventions for evidence-based prescribing and medicines use, selenium for preventing cancer, and community-wide interventions for increasing physical activity. Milo Puhan also talks about the latest Cochrane Library editorial on phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitors for COPD. The May issue of the Cochrane Library published 28 new Cochrane reviews, 33 updated reviews, and one editorial. You can access this content, including our featured podcasted reviews, through www.thecochranelibrary.com. Also on the homepage this month are our two special collections on asthma and tobacco smoking. World Asthma Day and World No Tobacco Day take place each May to raise awareness of asthma and its care and the health risks associated with tobacco use. Last year's collections have both been updated to include Cochrane reviews published in the past 12 months. You should also look out for the update of our International Clinical Trials Day collection and associated podcasts. The first of our Cochrane authors this month is Sophie Hill, coordinating editor of the Cochrane Consumers and Communications Group. She describes an overview of consumer-oriented interventions for evidence-based prescribing and medicines use, which includes evidence from several systematic reviews.
Medicines are the cornerstone of treatment for many health problems, but safe and effective use of medicines is a challenge for many health consumers. I use the term health consumer to refer to any person using medicines either as a patient or a family carer. In practice, there are many different kinds of interventions to help consumers use their medicines wisely. Familiar ones would be information pamphlets or education sessions. How effective are these types of interventions? Well, it's been hard to answer this question because the lessons from research have not been collated to enable us to look across the board. This makes it very difficult for governments or health professionals to find sound evidence about what to do or what to invest in. In the past, research into the use of medicines by consumers focused a great deal on the goal of adherence, a term that means whether people take their medicines as directed. In recent years, new ideas such as consumer empowerment or shared decision-making have been promoted. These concepts highlight the importance of communication and participation in health. Interventions directed to consumers on the topic of managing medicines might also, therefore, have a goal of informed patients with the skills to manage medicines and any adverse events, not only to take them as directed. These ideas have influenced this Cochrane overview of reviews. Our overview is a new tier in health research. It is an overview of systematic reviews. This means that it is an overview of the evidence from systematic reviews. The systematic reviews included in the overview had to be reviews of controlled studies of interventions directed to consumers. Interventions had to promote safe and effective use of medicines by consumers. This approach captures a huge range of different interventions, ranging from skills training through to financial strategies through to consumer participation in medicine care planning. From searching through thousands of systematic reviews, we found 37 relevant reviews. Collectively, the overview draws from hundreds of pieces of research. Having found the 37 reviews, what did they tell us? The first thing to say is that no single intervention achieved all the health outcomes we would like or were effective for all people. This might not be an achievable goal anyway. We did find that some interventions hold promise for achieving the outcomes of improving knowledge, adherence, improving clinical health outcomes, and use of services. There were four broad types, and I'll give an example for each type. One was self-monitoring. One kind of self-monitoring is where the patient who is taking anticoagulation medicine self-tests their blood and then readjusts treatment if necessary. Two was self-management. For example, self-management is managing your medicines. Three, interventions directly involving pharmacists, such as where a pharmacist does an assessment of all the patient's medicines. And 4 was simplified dosing. For instance, the frequency of doses is simplified from, say, 4 times a day to 2. There was a diverse group of interventions which seemed to improve adherence to medicines, but not all the time. These included reminders, education combined with self-management skills training, counselling or support, financial incentives, and lay health workers. Assembling the evidence across so many reviews also sheds light on ineffective strategies. For example, interventions that provide information alone are not effective for changing health or medicine-taking outcomes. Unfortunately, the evidence is very sparse for some populations, including children and family carers, or for people with more than one health problem. Our overview can be used in different ways. Health professionals who want to implement a new way to improve people's use of medicines can use it to consider the different options available and to inform their choice of strategy, particularly considering the different outcomes which have been demonstrated. Health research grant bodies could use the overview to set priorities for new research. This overview is important because most health systems are pursuing high quality and safe healthcare with increasingly limited resources, and medicines are a major cost for many individuals and for governments. The research we have compiled shows that there are many preventable problems which could be avoided through better communication or by having the right skills. By bringing all the relevant systematic reviews together in one place, our aim is to improve decision-making in health systems, which in turn will improve health.
Next up this month is Marie Brinkman from the Catholic University in Leuven, Belgium. Marie discusses the research gathered together in a new review combining observational and randomised trial data to investigate the effect of selenium in preventing cancer.
Selenium is an essential nutrient, and although many studies have reported its potential to reduce the risk of cancer, there have also been concerns that high doses may be harmful. As the role of selenium in cancer risk is currently controversial, and its effects on different body sites and between men and women are unclear, we investigated all the available literature for evidence of a possible link between selenium exposure and cancer risk in men and women, and the effects of selenium supplementation for cancer prevention in men and women. From a comprehensive search of several scientific databases, we included 55 studies containing more than 1 million participants in our systematic review. 49 of these studies were prospective observational studies. Where there were 5 or more studies relating to cancer at the same body site, we combined and analysed the data. This allowed us to estimate the effect of different levels of selenium on the risk of prostate, urinary bladder, lung, stomach, colon or colorectal, and female breast cancers. The 6 randomised trials investigated the effect of selenium supplementation on cancer prevention. We assessed the quality of these studies and summarised their overall results. We found some evidence from the observational studies that having higher levels of selenium was associated with reduced cancer mortality and incidence. This was more pronounced for men and some types of cancer, such as bladder and prostate cancers. Our results, however, should be interpreted with care, as they were complicated by concerns about the quality and diversity of the data and the potential influence from other factors such as healthier nutrition or lifestyle, more favourable jobs or overall living conditions. There was no evidence from the randomised trials that selenium supplementation helped to prevent the risk of non-melanoma skin cancer or prostate cancer. Results on the effect of selenium supplementation to prevent the risk of liver cancer were inconsistent. Furthermore, reports from the Nutritional Prevention of Cancer trial and the recent SELECT trial, which investigated the effect of selenium supplementation on the risk of prostate cancer, raise concerns that supplementation in some circumstances may be harmful. From our Cochrane review, we found no reliable evidence that low selenium levels were associated with an increased risk of cancer. There is also no evidence at the moment that selenium supplementation prevents cancer in men or women, particularly in those who are adequately nourished. After surveying the existing research base, we suggest that future observational studies and randomized trials focus on the effects of selenium in cancer risk and prevention and examine these for different types of cancer, males and females, and levels of selenium intake.
Alongside the expanding collection of Cochrane podcasts, the Cochrane Library publishes a journal club each month, which provides a range of resources, including a clinical summary, slideshow, and discussion points. This May, the Journal Club Review examines community-wide interventions for increasing physical activity, which was published in the April issue of the Library. Philip Baker, from the Queensland University of Technology and Queensland Health in Australia, discusses its findings.
People who are physically active have higher levels of health-related fitness and are less likely to develop disabling medical conditions and chronic diseases. Around the world, governments are looking to find ways to increase the physical activity of their populations. Community-wide programs are attractive because they aim to increase the physical activity of a whole population. They are, however, by their very nature, complex, consisting of multiple strategies, acting in different ways, on different levels, in an effort to reach an impact in an entire community. In this Cochrane Review, we asked whether community-wide, multi-strategic interventions increase community levels of physical activity. We also tried to find out whether the interventions are more effective in some parts of the community than others, in what circumstances they work, and which components matter most. Eligible interventions had to aim to reach the whole population and be made up of strategies from at least two broad groups out of a possible six. These were social marketing through local mass media, other communication strategies such as posters, flyers, information booklets, and websites, individual counseling by health professionals, the involvement of voluntary government and non-government organizations, running the interventions in specific settings like schools and workplaces, and environmental changes such as walking trails. We found 25 studies to include in the review. Three of these contained elements from all six groups, and a further three had something from five of the groups. Almost all the interventions involved building partnerships with local governments or non-government organizations. 18 studies included some form of individual counseling by a health professional. 17 involved a mass media campaign, and 9 included another communication strategy. 6 studies used environmental change strategies. The studies came from around the world, with 9 from North America, 8 from Europe, 4 from China, 2 from Australia, and 1 each from Iran and Pakistan. Unfortunately, there were no high-quality studies, and we categorized 16 as being of a high risk of bias. It was very challenging to interpret the results. The interventions, populations, and outcomes measured tend to be very different across the studies. Added to this, the limitations of the study designs, the quality of the studies and the inconsistent results made things even harder to decipher. Some interventions seemed to work, while others didn't. Only one study in urban China found that the intervention increased the proportion of the whole population that reached a predefined amount of physical activity. This study used an intense intervention in Beijing, which had substantial penetration into the community with door-to-door distribution of handouts, counseling by health practitioners, and the identification of those with high risk factors through an intense screening campaign in which 3/4 of the community participated. The study reported a 20% increase in the proportion of the population attaining physical activity. We tried to determine why some interventions appeared to work and others failed. However, these sorts of complex interventions can be difficult to pull apart in order to assess the contribution of contextual factors. For example, we explored whether interventions that were more intense reported more benefit, but found no evidence that more intense programs improve physical activity. In summary, our research highlights a lack of consistent evidence to show whether community-wide interventions increase population levels of physical activity, and it's unlikely that the evidence from the promising intensive programs in China can be applied to other countries. This points to the need for investment in rigorous studies with validated measurement tools and an exploration of the effects on the health equity gradient. From our side, we will be trying to keep this review up to date as these studies become available.
The resource material for the Journal Club can be found at www.cochranejournalclub.com. And finally, to our editorial podcast. Pharmaceutical interventions for COPD are a hot topic, and phosphodiesterase 4, or PDE4, inhibitors have been touted as a possible wonder drug. Milo Puhan, Associate Professor at the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Associate Editor of the Cochrane Airways Group, describes his thoughts on the new Cochrane Review.
The pharmaceutical industry is currently investing vast resources to develop drugs that provide benefits to patients with COPD. Phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitors are among the drugs that raise hopes that two important goals of the COPD management, symptom relief and risk reduction of exacerbations, can be targeted more effectively than it is currently possible. Over the last 10 years, industry-sponsored phase 2 and 3 randomized trials have been conducted to explore the efficacy and safety of PDE4 inhibitors, sulamilast and roflumilast in COPD patients. Are PDE4 inhibitors the long-needed magic pill for COPD patients? The comprehensive, high-quality systematic review by Chang and colleagues shed some light on the benefits and harms associated with PDE4 inhibitors. The Cochrane reviews identified 23 published and unpublished placebo-controlled trials on sulamilast and roflumilast that included 15,668 COPD patients with a wide range of disease severity and that had on average an average duration of around 6 months. The meta-analysis showed mixed results for benefit and harm outcomes. Both sulamilast and roflumilast reduced the risk for exacerbations and led to improvements of lung function of unclear clinical relevance compared to placebo, but left symptoms, health-related quality of life, or exercise capacity essentially unaffected. Both drugs, although a little more so for sulamilast, were associated with diarrhea, nausea, abdominal pain, headache, and unexplained weight loss that led to withdrawals from drug treatment. An important conclusion that authors draw from this systematic review is that it is likely that PDE4 inhibitors act independently from long-acting bronchodilators, which were allowed as co-medication in most trials. A recent network meta-analysis supports this finding, as it suggested that combination treatment that include PDE4 inhibitors reduce the risk for exacerbations to a greater extent than combination treatments without PDE4 inhibitors. At this point, it is difficult to judge the net benefit of PDE4 inhibitors. This is whether the benefits outweigh the harms. This uncertainty is reflected by the regulatory history of the two drugs. Sulamilast was submitted to the United States Food and Drug Administration, FDA, in December 2002. A FDA advisory board meeting was held in September 2003, where a majority voted against sulamilast because efficacy data were not convincing and because of safety concerns. Consequently, the FDA did not approve the drug, but issued an approvable letter for the COPD indication with the request for long-term studies. It is unclear whether such long-term studies have been completed and whether approval is still a goal of sulamilast. For roflumilast, the story is somewhat similar. In July 2009, the company manufacturing roflumilast submitted a new drug application to the FDA. In a widely publicized vote, the FDA advisory board voted in April 2010 against roflumilast because of too many adverse effects that would offset the modest benefits. However, the European Medicines Agency approved roflumilast in 2010, and the FDA recently followed this decision with approval of Romelast for the indication of reducing the risk for exacerbations in March 2011. Interestingly, the FDA asked for another trial where the design of the trial should be appropriate to demonstrate a clinically relevant beneficial effect of Romelast as an add-on therapy compared to a long-acting beta agonist and inhaled corticosteroid fixed-dose combination treatment, which does, however, not seem to address the safety concerns that exist. The benefit-harm balance of Romelast or more broadly of PDE4 inhibitors are at the center of the debate. Yet a comprehensive and transparent benefit-harm assessment that would guide decisions on a policy or an individual patient level seems to be lacking. The briefing book of the sponsor of Romelast includes a section called Benefit-Risk Assessment, which does, however, not provide any benefit-harm analysis, but rather belittles the importance of observed adverse effects. What should be done to inform decision-makers that are faced with uncertainty about the net benefit of PDE4 inhibitors? It is important to generate more evidence on the comparative effectiveness of PDE4 inhibitors and on the long-term benefits and harms, but it seems equally important and maybe more efficient to use the large body of evidence that already exists and learn more about the benefit-harm balance of PDE4 inhibitors. Important questions that should be addressed are: do patients experience adverse effects from PDE4 inhibitors every day or just occasionally? Does the addition of PDE4 inhibitors provide more days without symptoms? Or in other words, does the reduction of days with exacerbation offset the days with adverse effect symptoms? What are the absolute joint probabilities of experiencing the benefit, for example, no exacerbations, better lung function, and harm outcomes, as for example, gastrointestinal toxicity, headache, weight loss, over a certain period of time? How do the patients weigh the importance of avoiding a moderate or severe exacerbation over a certain period of time against adverse effects, which may be experienced every day or occasionally? These questions can be addressed by a combination of quantitative benefit-harm analysis, for example, incremental net health benefit analysis, probabilistic simulation methods, or multi-criteria decision analysis. Studies eliciting patient preferences about the relative importance of benefit-harm and harm outcomes, and short-term studies that describe the day-to-day variability of experiencing adverse effects. Zhang and colleagues have made a crucial first step of synthesizing the published and unpublished evidence on PDE4 inhibitors, a multidisciplinary effort using multiple research methods and data sources. Is now necessary to learn more about the benefit-harm balance of PDE4 inhibitors from the perspective of patients, healthcare providers, and policymakers.
Milo's editorial, the full text of the Cochrane reviews we've featured, as well as the special collections and journal clubs, can all be found at the Cochrane Library homepage. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening to the May roundup from thecochranelibrary.com.